Views and opinions expressed on this program are those of the guests and contributors, and not necessarily those of WFSU Public Media.
What's the 411? You're tuned in to 411 Teen, a weekly program for teens, parents, families, educators, and other interested folks. 411 Teen provides a forum to examine and analyze and discuss various issues and events that confront, intersect, and sometimes interrupt our daily lives. I'm Dr. Liz Holyfield. Throw a tantrum, explode, have a meltdown, lose our temper, go ballistic. There are so many names for losing our cool when life gets chaotic. Everyone loses cool sometimes. We all do it in different ways, and there are lots of ways to talk about freaking out. How to Stop Freaking Out, The Ultimate Guide to Keeping Cool When Life Feels Chaotic, written by Carla Nomberg, PhD. It's meant for kids and parents, too. Dr. Nomberg is a clinical social worker and the author of 5 books, including the bestseller, How to Stop Losing Your SH with Your Kids. Dr. Carla Nomberg, welcome to 411 Teen.
Call me Carla.
Okay. All right, Carla. Well, still, welcome to 411 Teen.
I'm so happy to be here.
Tell me, how did your journey as an expert in coping and emotional regulation begin? Because I notice all your books, or most of your books, are about coping and emotional regulation. So how did that begin? Share that, please.
It all started when my daughters, who are now teenagers, were really young, and I couldn't cope, and I had no emotional regulation. And, I was in the middle of working on my doctorate in clinical social work, which is kind of like an advanced degree in overwhelming feelings and confusing thoughts. And I thought, if I can't, I'm a doctor, I'm working on this stuff in my professional life, but personally, I felt totally out of control. I was freaking out at my kids. I was yelling at my daughters all the time. And I thought, this is not the kind of parent I want to be. This is not the kind of relationship I want to have with my children. So that led to the book that you mentioned previously, How to Stop Losing It with Your Kids. Mm-hmm. And then from there, How to Stop Freaking Out, my newest book, is kind of the middle grade companion to that book. They're both about emotional regulation and staying cool when things get chaotic.
Well, I really enjoyed your book. I liked the format, the chapter format, and the illustrations were visually appealing. It's just a delight. I enjoyed it. I think you will find that it will be a great success, because it's very, very engaging, and I'm sure that young folks and old folks, parents, can benefit from it, even though I know it was for, what, young folks only?
Well, first of all, thank you. I do want to give a shout out to the illustrator, Letizia Rizzo. She did an incredible job. Mm-hmm. Look, when I was writing this book, I was imagining that I was writing for a kid around the ages, I would say 8 to 11. But the truth is, the ideas and skills and strategies in this book are relevant to anyone and everyone. So I hope it will be useful to parents and teachers and school counselors and doctors as well.
Well, share with the listening audience just a brief overview of the book's purpose. And I guess we know the target audience. Just kind of give them an overview of the book.
Sure. So I start out by making clear that, you know, what a freak out is, to make sure we're all on the page about, on the same page, one might say, about what I mean when I'm using the word freak out. Then we talk about how to figure out if you're freaking out, in case you don't know. And then we talk about why we freak out, which is where we get into the idea that, you know, we all have these buttons that get pushed, and what to do to make your buttons less pushable, and what to do about the things, the people and experiences in our lives that do push our buttons, and then how to calm down after you freak out anyway. So I kind of try to walk readers through understanding what a freak out is, how to prevent them, but then what to do when they happen anyways, as they will for all of us from time to time.
Well, Carla, just what is a freak out? I mean, we've got all kind of names and words for it, but what is a freak out?
So I use an acronym in this book, which I also used in a previous book. And the acronym is FART, because I we have to laugh at this stuff. Yes. If we can't laugh at it, what are we going to do? But the word FART, you know, the letters stand for the primary attributes of a freakout. So F is for feelings, because they're powered by strong emotions. And most of the time, our freakouts come from unpleasant emotions like anger or anxiety, overwhelm or fear. But sometimes they can actually come from really positive emotions, too, as any parent who's ever seen a kid who's, you know, laughing so hard they tip over into crying. It happens. So F is for feelings. A and R are for automatic and reactive. You know, automatic is because sometimes our freakouts really feel like they just happen with the flip of a switch. They could, you know, we just, we're getting there, and then we just lose it, right? It feels very automatic. And the reactive is because our freakouts are generally in reaction to something that's happened, either internally or externally. And sometimes it happened right in that moment, and sometimes it happened an hour or two ago, and we've just been simmering on it the whole time. And then T is for too much, which means our reaction to whatever's going on is over the top. It's too extreme, it's too overwhelming, or too much for what actually happened. So it's feelings, automatic, reactive, and too much.
And there you identify five kinds of freakouts. Share that with the listening audience too, because I think very helpful.
Yeah, I think for the purpose of this book, I found five kinds. There might be more, but the first ones are going to be familiar to most listeners: fight, flight, or freeze. Right? This is sort of this very old, deep human reaction when we feel unsafe or out of control, which is we either gear up to fight, which may look like anything from slamming a door in your parents' face to throwing a remote control at your sibling, right? Flight can mean literally running away from the situation, or it could actually mean sort of checking out emotionally or psychologically in kind of an intense reactive way, you know, grabbing your phone and swiping through it rather than engaging in whatever's going on, or just kind of, you know, really disconnecting from the situation. And then freeze, it's just that moment where all of a sudden you're a deer in the headlights and you don't even know what to do, and you can't react, you can't respond because you've just freaked out in this moment. Often happens, you know, on the stage during a recital or during a game. And then the other two I have are fight, flight, freeze, flip out, and fix. So flip out, I wanted to include because sometimes we have these huge explosions that aren't really about fighting with someone, and it's, you know, maybe you just hurl a ball really hard at a window when you don't mean to, or you just start screaming and you toss your textbooks off the table. Like, these really intense moments can happen. And then the fixing behavior is actually something we see when someone is so desperate to end an uncomfortable situation or avoid a conflict, where what we hear is, okay, you can have whatever you want. Just, you know, you can have the last cupcake. I'll do whatever. Just take it. They just want this moment to end.
Right.
And even though it seems like they're just trying to solve the problem, it's actually really coming from this place of freaking out.
Well, why do you think it's essential for middle schoolers to have a guide, on emotional regulation? I guess that's the best way to say it.
I think it's essential for everyone to have this. And I think it's exciting that we live in a time where people are starting to acknowledge for the first time that we need to be talking to kids about thoughts and feelings and behaviors. You know, when I was in middle school, we didn't talk about bullying. We didn't talk about mental health or mental illness. We didn't talk about the ups and downs of daily life. That was not part of the curriculum. And, you know, a lot of adults weren't talking about that either. And so now we are in this world, for better or for worse, and I think generally for better, where there's a lot of self-help information out there. And all of a sudden, we're sharing it with kids. And I think kids do want to understand themselves and do want to feel more in control of themselves. And so it's really exciting that we have authors and publishers and illustrators who are willing to build these products that we can share with kids so they can really have a chance to understand their own experiences better.
Well, what's been the response that you have gotten from kids?
generally overwhelmingly positive. One of my best friends has an 8-year-old daughter, and she sent me a text of her with images of her daughter reading the book, and saying that her daughter wants to give this book to her therapist because she thinks the therapist should be recommending this to other book to other readers. I had another person email me and say that they work on an inpatient psychiatric unit, which is where I used to work. I started my social work career on a unit like that. And that there was a young person on the unit who had been really struggling with physical outbursts. And after she read this book, the outburst stopped. And I don't have more information about exactly how it helped her, but I got tearful when I read that. It meant so much to me. And then on the flip side, there were my own daughters who, when we got our first copies of the book, they immediately started paging through it and doing dramatic reenactments, dramatic readings of every page.
Really?
It was hilarious.
I bet it was.
It was really funny. But generally, everything I've been hearing is that the kids are really loving it, which means so much to me, particularly because most kids I know aren't walking around begging for a book about emotional regulation. So if I've managed to write one that is really grabbing kids' interest and holding it, that means the world to me.
Now, Carla, just share with the listening audience, and I'll ask you to do this several times throughout the conversation, where one can get your book. I'm talking with Carla Naumburg, and her book is How to Stop Freaking Out, The Ultimate Guide to Keeping Cool When Life Feels Chaotic.
This book is available wherever readers like to buy books, on Amazon, Barnes & Noble, or your local independent bookseller.
Okay, that sounds good. So you can get it wherever you want, almost any place. And if they don't have it, I'm sure they can order it.
Absolutely. And if your local library doesn't have a copy, you can put in a request. You can ask your library to get it for you, which is really cool.
Well, and I was thinking about donating my book to the local library. I thought that would be really good. But they probably could use more than one.
Yeah, ask them to get it. I've done that because with all my books, because I'm just a huge fan of my local library, and I'm there about once a week.
Mm-hmm. Well, you're tuned in to 411 Teen. My guest today is Dr. Carla Naumburg, clinical social worker and author of How to Stop Freaking Out. Her writing has appeared in the New York Times, Washington Post, Huffington Post, CNN, among other places. Our conversation will continue after a brief break. Just tuning in, the program is 411 Teen. I'm Dr. Liz Hollyfield, and my guest today is Dr. Carla Naumburg, clinical social worker and author of How to Stop Freaking Out. Carla, what are the triggers? What would you identify as triggers for emotional outbursts in young folks? We're talking about late elementary, middle school age?
Absolutely. And okay. I think the triggers for kids those ages are actually very similar for the triggers for most of us. So exhaustion, fatigue, hunger, physical pain. If you're in any kind of pain, that'll get you going. Mm-hmm. Grief, if you've lost a grandparent or a pet or something like that. Major life transitions. As you and I are having this conversation, kids are just going back to school. And that transition of starting the new year, learning all the new strategies, can be a major trigger. You know, any huge changes in your life, a sibling who's leaving the house, going off to college, going off to the military, whatever mm-hmm. it may be, parents getting a divorce, all of these life situations can be triggers. Times of day or times of the year can be triggers. For many of us, we're extra sort of on edge in the evenings just because we're tired. We've been doing the hard work of standing in line and following rules and listening to the teacher and filling out worksheets and all those things all day. And so in the afternoons or evenings, we're exhausted and a little more prone to freaking out. The holidays, can be a major trigger. Not only, you know, for the adults, it's a lot about maybe expectations or difficult memories, but for kids, it can just be the overexcitement, the change in daily routine. That can be triggering. And then individual kids are going to have different triggers. So let me give you an example. Let's say you are either the shortest or the tallest kid in your class, and you come into the classroom, a new classroom for the first day. Your height may be a trigger for you, that if someone makes some comment about how either short or tall you are, you know, that might be something that really pushes your buttons. Whereas for a kid who's of a more typical height, that's not a trigger for them. So if somebody comments on how tall they are, it won't go anywhere near their buttons. So there are really universal triggers, and then each of us have unique triggers. An example of a unique trigger for me is, well, let's see, really loud noises. Some people don't mind them, but I find the loud noise of, say, a concert to be pretty overwhelming and really pushes my buttons. Whereas my husband and my younger daughter, they love the like really loud noise of sounds of live music, and that works for them. So it really depends on the person, but there are a lot out there.
Well, it's, what is it? Different strokes for different folks.
Yes.
Explain the psychological and physiological processes that kids experience, kids go through when they are freaking out.
So the really, I think, interesting stuff about what's happening in that moment is that most of the things we are about to talk about, kids aren't even aware of. And it's not just a kid thing, it's actually an adult thing. But when we are in the process of freaking out, the part of our brain that notices, that might say, hey, you're freaking out now, this is our prefrontal cortex, is literally not available to us.
Right.
It has shut off. And our limbic system, which is the part of our brain that's kind of responsible for the fight, flight, freeze, flip out, fix response, that's running the show. That's really in charge. And that part of our brain doesn't care about noticing. So it's just trying to do whatever it needs to do to get us through the moment. The other things that can happen when we are freaking out is that our heart rate might start speeding up. Our muscles get tense. Our vision can change, and we can literally get tunnel vision in some cases. Your stomach might hurt, or you might feel like you're going to throw up. And that's actually because we have a whole nervous system wrapped around our digestive system, which is crazy to think about. Our thoughts might start racing. Like all of, you know, our body really can get very tense and amped up. And so that's why one of the most powerful ways to calm down when we notice we're freaking out is to start by calming our bodies. But those are just a few of the things that can happen.
Okay. When I was talking with several folks and telling them about the book, I got the same question from three people. So I'm going to make sure I pose it to you now before I forget it. They wanted to know, ask her, how the emotional meltdowns differ, if there's a difference between the adolescent and from those in younger children or adults. So is there a difference? Is there a difference between the meltdowns, whether they're young children, adults, or adolescents? Because I guess they feel there is, and they're seeing it. I don't know. We didn't elaborate, but they wanted me to ask that question, so I thought I better ask it now.
That is a fantastic question, and my brain is working away at it. I don't know enough about what's going on in the actual brain to comment on that. But what I will say is, right off the bat, a few different thoughts come to mind. One is a middle grader, an adolescent, is going to be much more aware of and responsive to their environment and the context they're in. So, you know, a four-year-old is happy to have a meltdown anywhere, in the grocery store, in, you know, at preschool, at grandma's house. Doesn't matter where they are. If that's the vibe they're going for, they're going to melt down, right?
Right.
I think an adolescent is going to work a lot harder to hold it together at school, in front of their friends, in, you know, the outside world, in the grocery store. Which is great. That's what we want to go for. So when parents say to me, I don't understand why, you know, I hear these great reports from the teacher, but my kid is a mess at home. Well, that doesn't mean your kid couldn't use the book, like we don't want kids melting down all over the place at home either, because it's exhausting and unpleasant for everyone. But the good news is they have some strategies and some coping skills that they're using at school, but all that coping at school gets exhausting and then they come home and lose it. I think adult meltdowns, you know, can be, I think, even more out of control in some situations. And as a social worker, I think about situations like domestic violence. And mm-hmm. I think that does happen, of course. I also think we see these meltdowns happening a lot on the internet in terms of the like horrible comments that people leave for each other, the really awful emails people will send to each other. And I think with adults, the meltdowns can be tied to substance use, you know, when someone is drunk or intoxicated. And certainly mm-hmm. that can happen in the teenage years too. But I think that in some cases, if adults are really out of control, that's also something you would want to look at.
Well, you mentioned strategies. What are some of the main strategies you recommend for kids to stop emotional outbursts before they escalate?
So this is where we show up with another hilarious acronym. This is where we start talking about BURPS, which are mm-hmm. our button reduction practices. I'm particularly proud of that one. You know, the idea is that we have all these buttons all over our body, and when they get pushed, you know, we're much more likely to freak out. And we can't always control the people or situations in our lives that are going to push our buttons. But what we can do is try to make our buttons smaller, dimmer, less pushable. And so in the book, I give readers 26, a whole alphabet, A to Z, 26 strategies for taking care of your buttons, for making them smaller and harder to find and harder to push. So, you know, a big one that I always talk about is breathing. And we hear about this so much, but that's because it's so powerful. When we stop and just notice our breath mm-hmm. and take a few big, slow, deep breaths, it's kind of like sending a text message to your nervous system saying, hey, it's okay. You can calm down. Other strategies are really going to vary depending on what the person, the kid, the adult prefers. So for me, I find it really useful to go outside, even just to my front steps, and take some big, deep breaths of fresh air. That's a great strategy for me. Some kids are going to want to run around and move their bodies. Other kids might want to journal, draw, express themselves artistically. Other kids might want to recite a prayer or a mantra or favorite song lyrics or turn on, you know, music. Mm-hmm. Spending every time cuddling with your pet if you have one, or, you know, reading a good book. There are lots of different strategies we can use to kind of take our level of stress and tension and kind of the extent to which our nervous system is jacked up, take it down a notch. What you will notice is that none of these strategies involve our phones or our screens. You know, I'm not anti-phone. I have mine. I love mine. But it's not great for as a button reduction practice.
Okay. Middle schoolers, how can they begin to recognize their emotional triggers? Because lots of times they don't know what they are. Do you have any suggestions as to what they can do in recognizing these emotional triggers?
Absolutely. And in defense of middle schoolers, most humans don't know what their emotional triggers okay. are. I mean, I didn't know what mine were until I really started doing this work in my 30s. Mm-hmm. So the first step is to know that they exist. And your podcast and this book are a great place to start. The second is to find some way to reflect on your freakouts or your difficult moments. And often what'll happen is right after a kid's freaked out, you know, they're still kind of breathing hard. They're still upset. The parent will say, what happened? And the kid goes, I don't know. And the parent thinks, oh, well, they don't know because they're a kid. But the truth is we don't yet know if they don't know, but they're not going to be able to think through it when they're still coming down off a freakout. Their nervous system is too jacked up. Their brain is still trying to calm things down. It's not the time to reflect. Mm-hmm. So having either journaling about it is, for some kids, writing really works. Talking to a therapist, talking to a counselor at school, talking to a parent or an aunt and uncle or a cousin, a trusted adult, but trying to think through what is going on in your life, what happened right before the freak out. So let's say you get home and your sister says something annoying and you throw your shoe at her and then you get in trouble and then you stomp off and lose it. So maybe it really is that your sister, there's something about what she says that's really pushing your buttons. Or maybe it's that your grandfather was just admitted to the hospital and you just found out, you know, a couple days ago and it's been on your mind, but you haven't had a chance to talk to anyone about it and you're scared and worried. And it's kind of too much, so that when your sister shows up and does her sister thing, and that's what siblings do, it sends you over the edge. And so starting to understand that triggers are a thing that exist, and then taking the time to get to know yours. And I'm pretty transparent with my daughters about mine. They know that when I'm exhausted, when I haven't exercised, when I'm stressed about work, on my birthday, you know, these are all times of the year that for, well, times of the year and also states, you know, physical and emotional states for me, that these are my triggers. And so my daughter was actually, after she was away at summer camp for 7 weeks, she's 15 years old. She was able to say to me when we picked her up from camp, "Mom, I didn't sleep at all last night. I stayed up with my friends and I'm really sad about leaving them. So I'm probably going to be incredibly grumpy on the 5-hour car ride home." I was like, well, that stinks for me because I'm stuck in a car with a grumpy kid. But you just identified triggers. You just know you're exhausted and you know you're sad. And just saying that made the whole situation so much less tense for all of us. So you kids can get there. They really can.
Can they practice? Do you recommend they practice emotional regulation techniques? I mean, like even, you know, the breathing. Does that help? Is that something that you would advise? You know, if they're to a point where they know what their triggers are, and they know some, they really are aware and have been informed of different techniques, is practicing advantageous, is what I'm trying to say.
Practicing is everything. Okay. It is crucial.
Okay.
So look, we have two choices in life if we have triggers. One is to totally avoid them, which in very rare circumstances is a possibility. You know, I know that live concerts are a trigger for me, so I just don't go to them. That's easy, right? I can't avoid my birthday. Like, if I'm lucky, it'll happen every single year, right?
Right.
And so there are many triggers in life, whether it's an ambulance coming down the road, whether it's, you know, the fear of getting a vaccination, whether it's the stress of an algebra test coming up, that we just can't avoid. And so practicing our burps every single day, because the triggers happen every single day, is crucial. And but the reason I gave 26 different options for kids is because I want them to know that these are things that hopefully they are doing anyways, they're doing every day anyways, and that can be fun. So some examples are, you know, grin and giggle. I just want to remind people that we need to laugh sometimes, right? That's a powerful way. Kick a ball, get outside, kick a ball, listen to your favorite music, read your favorite book, snuggle your cat, go for a walk, you know, stretch your body, get some sleep, take your deep breaths. There's nothing really complicated about any of these, but if we don't make time to do them every single day, our buttons are going to be so big and bright and pushable that we're just going to lose it all the time. And that's not a great way to go through life.
What happens? What's the long-term impact of unmanaged emotional regulation in middle schoolers?
That is an interesting question. So I don't know if we have data about that. So I'm going to speak from perspective. It's definitely my perspective. So here are my thoughts. I think that for most middle schoolers, they'll be fine. We all freak out, right? And especially in middle school when hormones are raging and transitions are happening and our bodies are changing and everything feels hard. There are more freakouts than, you know, maybe other times of life. And chances are most kids are going to be okay. But in the moment, freakouts make life feel harder. They can damage relationships. They can make it less likely that we get what we want to get. You know, if you want to go to a sleepover and your parents say no because it's granny's birthday and you absolutely lose it, chances are your parents are going to double down and say, well, now you definitely can't go.
Exactly.
Whereas if you could say, you know, is there some kind of, if the kid can stay calm, and this is not easy to do for kids or adults, but if the kid can stay calm and say, hey, is there some kind of compromise we could work out here? Is there a way, you know, maybe if I can't go to sleepover, maybe I could host one the next weekend, or, you know, can I go to grandma's and then leave, you know, get to the sleepover late? But if the kid is freaking out, they're not going to be able to have this conversation, and then they don't get what they want. So I think in most cases, there probably aren't too many long-term effects, but as you get older, if your freakouts continue and they become more frequent or intense, it really could start having an impact on your, again, your ability to make and sustain friendships and relationships, to do well in school, to succeed at jobs. Over time, uncontrolled freakouts can really become a problem, I think.
Yeah, I mean, and I think it can become a pattern. That's the way that you handle your emotions, and that you continue. And as you get older, they may become more of a problem, more of an issue, you know, because you're going to handle it inappropriately in the first place. But if you're older and acting like that, then that really creates a problem.
I completely agree with you. And I like to tell my kids and remind myself that we're always practicing something, whether or not it's something we actually want to get better at. So if every time I feel a strong, overwhelming emotion and I just let myself lose it, I'm practicing that. And that tendency to freak out is going to become more natural. I'm going to revert to it more quickly. Whereas if every time I notice myself feeling a strong, overwhelming, unpleasant emotion and I really want to lose it, I choose to go outside and do 12 jumping jacks instead.
Hold your thoughts right there, okay? We got to take a break, but I'll get right back at you.
Views and opinions expressed on this program are those of the guests and contributors, and not necessarily those of WFSU Public Media.
Just tuning in, I'm Dr. Liz Hollifield, and I'm talking with Carla Nombach, author of How to Stop Freaking Out, The Ultimate Guide to Keeping Cool When Life Feels Chaotic. The book will guide you through all the twists and turns on the roller coaster of life. The trick is knowing how to manage them. Carla, I had to interrupt you, and you want to continue your thoughts.
Absolutely. I was just saying that we're always practicing something, whether or not we want to get better at that particular thing. So are you going to practice freaking out, screaming and yelling, losing your temper? Or are you going to practice taking deep breaths, doing some jumping jacks outside? Whichever one you do more, that's the one you'll be more likely to do because you've been practicing it.
Well, what role do teachers and peers, as I think about it, both teachers and peers, play in helping kids manage their emotions?
So any non-parent adult, whether it's a teacher or a school counselor or coach, tutor, plays a really powerful role in a kid's life, especially as kids get to middle school and beyond, because part of their developmental work at these ages is to start to separate in small but significant ways from their parents as they prepare to, you know, eventually leave the house in many situations. And so I don't know about your listeners, but certainly my experience with my daughters is they're not super interested in my advice or suggestions these days. So I can make a suggestion from them and they pretty much blow it off, which is okay. That's all right. That's their job right now. And then their coach, their teacher will say the exact same thing. And it's a brilliant idea coming from them, right?
Right.
This is normal. It doesn't mean your kid hates you. It doesn't mean that you're not a good parent. It's just part of the deal. And so our job as parents is to take a deep breath, put it all in context and not freak out. And to be really grateful of and supportive of the other adults in our kids' lives who can say things to our kids, give them advice, give them suggestions that our children may be more likely to hear. I think peers are also perhaps more powerful than ever peer relationships in these middle and high school years. And so that's why I'm so grateful when my kids make friends who I think, I don't want to say a positive influence because I think it goes beyond that, who exist in this world in kind and positive ways, because I do think our children really look to their peers for who do I want to be and what am I going to do and how am I going to behave. And if you're fortunate enough that your kids end up with good influences, that's amazing. That's really powerful.
Now, is there anything that you would recommend that parents avoid in these moments to prevent escalation?
I think the most powerful thing we can do when our kids are freaking out and we don't want to escalate it is we need to stay calm ourselves.
Okay.
So if you are a parent like me who gets triggered when your kids are freaking out, you need to work extra hard, as I do, to stay calm. And one of the big reasons for that is because the part of our kids' brains that helps them calm down in these difficult moments, the prefrontal cortex that kind of exists right behind our forehead, isn't fully online for kids and young adults until they're about 24 years old or so, early to mid-20s. And so in that moment, when they don't have a fully functioning prefrontal cortex, they need us to show up with that calm, measured energy. They need to essentially borrow from us what they don't have for themselves. And so I think the thing I don't want parents to do, if it's possible, I don't want you to freak out at your kids. And man, that is a tall order. And it took me years to get out of that dynamic, years of working hard. But, you know, and saying to your kid, obviously, you need to calm down, isn't going to work. When my husband says that to me in my bad moments, I just get angry. Nobody wants to hear that. But if we can stay calm and do our best to, you know, offer kids coping mechanisms, whether it's, do you need to listen to music? Do you need to pull out your journal? Do we need to go outside and go for a walk? And ideally, your kid will choose one. Sometimes they'll be so distressed, they won't want to hear that either. And then if you can just kind of stay near them and stay calm, that may be the best we can do in those moments until the moment passes.
What about teachers now who witness these emotional outbursts in classrooms?
You know, I am not an educator, and I have never taught children in a classroom setting. Mm-hmm. And so I'm reticent to give teachers advice because they are an incredible group of people who just do some of the most important work that's out there. But what I would suggest for teachers, that I would suggest for anyone, is know who your supports are in the school. You know, your resource officer, your school counselor, your teaching aide, whoever it is. And I don't think any teacher out there isn't going to already know this. Mm-hmm. But, you know, certainly know who your supports are and do what you can to take care of your own buttons, to take your deep breaths, to give yourself a break when you can, to get outside when you can. And I'm sure there are teachers listening to this who are thinking, you have no idea how chaotic my day is. I truly don't. But I would hope that every teacher has the support and information and resources they need to take care of themselves so they can show up in as calm and present a manner as possible, because they really do have an unbelievable job.
Well, do you have suggestions or thoughts about how the school itself could implement a culture that supports emotional regulation? Now that might be
Yeah, I do actually, and I have to say, these ideas don't come from my study of the research. What they come from is what I've seen be really effective at my daughter's school. And a few different ideas that come to mind, which teachers may already be doing. But first of all, having kids check in at the beginning of the day with the teacher, and whether that's giving them a fist to five, which is just a really quick way, either showing a fist or a five or two fingers or whatever it is, but it's a really quick way to just check in with a teacher and let them know, you know, I'm doing great. That's a high five. I'm not doing well at all. That's a closed fist or anywhere in between. And I like the idea of using your hand, because sometimes it can be hard for kids to find the words to use, right? Mm-hmm. Another way to do it is to just to have different colored, maybe pieces of paper on a wall or a place on a whiteboard where kids can put their names with a sticker or magnet or something. Are they in the red, green, or yellow? So green means I'm good to go, right? I'm ready to learn. I'm here. I'm present. Yellow means I'm hanging in there, but I might need a little support. And red is I am not in a place to be in the classroom. I am not in a place to learn. And so teachers really know what to expect and what kids may need a little extra support or need to take a break in that moment. Mm-hmm. Other things I've seen work well include having a break space in the classroom, which might be, you know, a small corner, a space with a comfortable cushion, maybe a stuffed animal, maybe a couple of picture books to look at, maybe some fidget toys, and usually like a sand timer or something like that, where mm-hmm. a kid can just go, take a break, and when the timer's over, they can come back out. I've seen that be really effective. And the last one is that we really need schools to be supported in having plenty of time for kids to move their bodies throughout the day, ideally outside mm-hmm. if possible. But kids' bodies, man, human bodies were not designed to sit in chairs all day long, and especially kids, they mm-hmm. need to stretch, they need to move, and they need to breathe fresh air. And that's going to go a long way for a lot of kids. And unfortunately, those decisions often aren't made at the teacher level. And I hope that the schools would work to really create a culture where kids can get out and move their bodies.
Well, at what point would you recommend one needs professional intervention?
Yeah, you know, this is a really
tried all these
question.
Suggestions, you know, done everything, and they still aren't making progress. And it's at school, it's at home, it's wherever, okay? But they don't seem to be able to manage it. The teacher, the parent, whomever is just at wit's end. When do they go? And how do they select where they go, who they see?
Yeah, such crucial questions. Mm-hmm. So if I'm talking to a kid, what I would say to the kid is anytime you feel like for any reason that you need support from an adult, you go get it. And you find an adult that you feel like you can talk to. Again, whether it's a family member, mm-hmm. a teacher, the gym teacher, your coach, your cello teacher, whatever it is, anytime. Now, if I'm talking to a parent, and the parent is wondering, does my kid need help? You know, there are a few ways to think about this. One is, have you seen a marked change in your child's behavior? Are they freaking out significantly more than they used to? That's something to notice. Do the freakouts continue, right? Are you seeing this behavioral dysregulation last over weeks or months? The longer it lasts, obviously, that's concerning. Mm-hmm. As you mentioned, is it happening in a variety of settings, right? Because if we see it happening basically everywhere the kid is hanging uh-huh. out, what that means is they don't have any skills for managing it. I'm much more concerned about those kids than the kids who can hold it together at school, at practice, at grandma's house, but then they come home and lose it.
Mm-hmm.
Are the freakouts getting in their way of doing what they want to do? Are they getting kicked out of the, you know, the Boy Scout troop? Are they mm-hmm. getting left out of sleepovers? Are they not getting invited to do things? You know, is the tutor saying, I don't really want to work with your kid anymore, right? Uh-huh. Are the freakouts making it such that your kid is unable to participate in all the activities or the things they want to do? That's concerning. And if you're not sure, talk to someone who spends a lot of time with a lot of kids. So whether it's your pediatrician, again, the teacher, the school counselor, mm-hmm. any therapist, and either, you know, describe to them what's going on, and they can probably give you a sense of, yeah, that sounds within the range of pretty normal for what we would expect for this age, or that does sound concerning. Now, in terms of the type of help you would want, to be honest, for most people, it's very hard to choose what you want because we are constrained by the resources available in your area, the therapist that actually happens to call you back, or what your health insurance will pay for. And that's just a real problem of our the way our healthcare society works, right? It's just the reality of it. So I'm always reticent to say to people, this is the kind of therapist you should get, because what I know is that for most folks, that choice isn't an option. Having said that, if you do have a choice, what we know is that the person that your child will go talk to and actually talk to and build any kind of relationship with, that's the first and most important choice. We know from the data that the most effective therapy happens when there's a good relationship. But you also want a therapist who's going to communicate with the parents and is going to be able to identify, this is what I think is going on with your kid. This is why I think it's why it's happening. This is the plan for how we're going to work on it. And this is how we're going to know if what we're doing is working.
In these last few minutes, of course, I still have a thousand questions I could think of asking you. But how have you noticed an increase in emotional dysregulation in children since the pandemic? And I know you probably always get this question, but I mean, it's just appropriate for where we are at this time. And just wondering, have you noticed anything?
For the first couple of years after the pandemic, absolutely, for sure. Mm-hmm. Kids were more anxious, they were more depressed, and they were more disconnected. And all of those experiences make our buttons so pushable. I mean, irritability is a central symptom of anxiety and depression that many people don't realize. And so, yes, you know, it was happening in adults too. But anytime a person of any age feels unsafe, and I think during the pandemic, we all felt deeply unsafe, our buttons are huge and big and bright and pushable, and we're just on the edge of freaking out at every moment. What I am seeing and hearing now is that things are starting to trend back towards whatever our baseline is. And, you know, young people have dealt with scary situations through all of humanity, whether it was, I don't know, polio or nuclear war or, you know, World War One. Like, the world has always been a scary place. I think that social media has added an additional layer of stress and anxiety that most of humanity never had to deal with. But I do think we're finding out what the new baseline is. But our kids are always going to go through their lives, their entire lives, with an awareness that the world could just shut down at any time. And that's something that, you know, I'm very lucky. I spent the first 40 some odd years of my life thinking that was only something that happened in science fiction movies.
Right.
And so that's a new reality for the next generation that hopefully will lead to resilience rather than struggles. But I think it's a challenging reality.
What is the one piece of advice you'd give to a middle schooler who is struggling to manage their emotions?
I would encourage them to cut themselves a whole lot of slack, to find a way to let go of the shame, to let go of the embarrassment. And boy, is that hard, because there's a lot of embarrassment in middle school. And to remember that if life feels hard, it's not necessarily because they're doing it wrong. It's because life is really hard for all of us. And when we can stop blaming and shaming and feeling bad about ourselves, life feels a whole lot easier. And that's what I would wish for all of us.
In this last minute, 45 seconds, any words of wisdom you may share with parents and teachers?
Honestly, I would probably say the exact same thing. If life and adulting and teaching and parenting feel relentlessly, unbelievably hard, again, it's not because you're doing it wrong. It's because this is a really hard thing we're doing. Raising the next generation of humans is incredibly hard. And if you're just showing up every day, then you're doing the work, and I'm grateful for it.
Well, it is time out for this edition of 411 Teen. Many thanks to Dr. Carla Nomberg for sharing her insights and her expertise about emotional regulation. Check out her book, Surviving Your Teenager and Being Happy Anyway. That's it for this edition of 411 Teen. Tune in next week to get the 411 on 411 Teen, same time, same place. Teen was produced by Dr. Liz Hollyfield. Technical assistance was provided by Evan Rossi. If you would like to participate in the 411 Teen or have suggestions for discussion topics, call 850-645-7200. You can listen to previous episodes of 411 Teen at wfsu.org.